Let me get started. So, there's the book that Geraint Lewis and I authored. I want to take you through part of that book tonight, but there's obviously a lot more than I can cover in this amount of time. In particular, what we're looking at is a puzzle and a proper head-scratcher, one that, you know, in the middle of last year, I was at a conference with a whole heap of people from around the globe, organised by Oxford University's Consolidation of Fine-Tuning Project, banging our head against this particular problem. So this is not some sort of, you know, easy quiz that we can all take a 50-50 guess on. This is something that scientists are really thinking very hard about. And I'm going to try and kill the lights. So good luck, everyone. At least the front, the stage. All yours.
Thank you.
All right. So I'm an astronomer. And the reason that a lot of us do astronomy is pretty simple. It's because the universe looks like that. That's all you need is a decent SLR camera. That's exactly not we.
Oh, sorry. Opposite.
Opposite to that. Wonderful. The universe looks like that. One of the great things about being an astronomer is what happens when you tell someone you're an astronomer. And you don't have to be an astronomer to tell someone that. If you're ever at a party, just try it and see what happens. Of course, you know, just see what response you get. If you want no one to talk to you at a party, by the way, just say you're an astrophysicist. That's the way to do that. But you get a variety of responses. The worst answer to the response is, oh, you're an astronomer. I'm a Capricorn. Yeah. I've gotten that before. But every now and then someone gives me a no.
No.
Yeah, whatever. It's not too bad, is it? Every now and then I get a story from someone about this time when they saw the universe, they saw the night sky, and it comes up in all sorts of varieties. They were trekking through Tanzania once. I had a guy who was a British, he was a submariner in the British Navy, and they were, it was the manliest story I've ever heard in my life. They were tracking Russian subs in the Arctic, and at night you couldn't make any noise, so all there was left to do was to get up on the top of the submarine and look up at the stars, right? And you're saying you're an astronomer, people just sort of have to tell you the story. And it comes in all sorts of forms, right? So people get into astronomy via a whole heap of ways. There's people who get into the space missions, the Sputniks and the Apollos too easy, and all sorts of other things. There are people who had telescopes from when they were very young. And one of the wonderful things about the universe is not only can you take that sort of photo with a decent camera, but if you get a great big telescope and look really hard at the universe, it looks even more beautiful. And even just the random stuff lying around. That's just a cloud of dust, right? Just out there in the universe. When I dust my house, it doesn't look that good. So these are the clouds from which stars form. Once a star is formed, it will run on a certain fuel. And if it needs to change the fuel source, so suppose it's run out of hydrogen and needs to run on helium, it needs to sort of reorganize itself a bit. It can throw off a bit of the matter that's in its outer layers, and that will form what's called a planetary nebula. And you really should get a good quality high resolution screen and a nice dark room, and put on some, Beethoven, get a nice scotch, get on the Hubble Space Telescope website and really look at all the detail in these sorts of pictures. There are stars that are too big to do that kind of fuel change, and so they blow up, leaving supernova remnants. And if a whole heap of stars that haven't blown up get together and take a family photo, then you get a galaxy. This is the kind of beauty that we just naturally see in the night sky. You just build a great big telescope and have a look, and this is what turns up. If, like me, you're also a maths nerd, then there's another type of beauty out there in the universe. There are beautiful patterns that describe the way all of these pieces work together. The laws of nature themselves are written in beautiful mathematical forms. So I want to give you a very quick introduction to what the universe is made of from the bottom up, and that'll send us towards our particular puzzle. So let me give you a very quick introduction to particle physics. If you're a particle physicist, your job is as follows. Grab two things, smash them together as fast and hard as you can and see what comes out of the wreckage. And in particular, try to break it into the smallest pieces so we know the smallest bits of the universe. And that is particle physics. Right? If a particle physicist were here, he'd probably say astronomy is looking up. it's that level of simplification. So the stuff that we're all made of, when we smash it together and try to see what's there, boils down to actually three different types of particle. So here's one for next year's next event's quiz. There's an up quark and a down quark and an electron. So as far as we know, that's the smallest bits that we're all made out of. So what can we make out of those? Well, you're hopefully familiar with the proton and the neutron. So it takes two up quarks and a down quark to make a proton, and one up quark and two down quarks to make a neutron, for when you're in your kitchen later on tonight. If you put protons and neutrons together, you can make the nuclei of atoms. They will hold together in certain combinations. You need the neutrons in there, of course. And the reason that's important is that there's not only one way of doing that that's stable. There are, in fact, all of the ways that there are in the periodic table of elements. So the number here in the table is just how many protons did you stick in the nucleus. And that gives us all the different elements that we are familiar with from chemistry. The electrons orbit around the outside, and one of the wonderful things about those electrons is if you put some nuclei close to each other and then put some electrons around them, they won't just stick to their own little one. They will, in fact, orbit around the whole sort of Mickey Mouse structure here and bind the whole thing together. And that, in two sentences, is chemistry. If you're a physicist, that's all we're really interested in. It's just some electrons bouncing around. Our universe is really good at this. Okay? Take hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, carbon, and phosphorus, put them in this particular arrangement. The electrons will wind their way through the whole thing, and you can literally write the instructions for a person. That's DNA, or any living thing that we're aware of. Specifically, whatever rung you put across the ladder is a particular letter, and certain letters are codes for proteins. And if you put enough proteins together via the magic of biochemistry, you can make cells, which are fantastically complicated. There's all sorts of wonderful details about cells which blow the minds of the physicist, because, you know, we love simplicity, and this thing's just amazing. If the cell needs to get a molecule from one side to another, it will quite literally put an address on the molecule, put it on a little truck, send that truck down a highway. The address will be checked by other molecules, and when it reaches its destination, it will be unloaded and put to use. Right? Molecules do all of that, right? Which is kind of amazing that you can just take these basic pieces of the universe, and the Lego set has three bits, but you can make this out of it. And if you put enough cells together, you can actually make small people. So with some assembly required, you can turn up and duck down quarks into electrons. So you can try that later. Better methods are available. I enjoy doing that joke at high schools because they don't get it. So, I'm the one laughing, but I enjoy the fact that I'm the only one laughing. So here's the short story. You're made of stuff. And we know basically, at least down to a certain level, what that stuff is and what it does and how it interacts via certain mathematical laws. Now, if you're a theoretical physicist like myself, this raises a whole heap of questions. We'd love to know why the universe is like that rather than some other way. Why those particular laws? Why is the universe the way it is? And it raises a related question that we're going to attack, which is hopefully will give us a clue to the other question, which is what if? What if things had been different? So I have laws that describe how the universe works, and they have, you know, electrons in them. What if I change the properties of electrons? So, for example, what if I made gravity stronger? What would happen to the universe? You're all familiar with gravity. You're all sitting on the floor. You're not sitting on the roof. That's gravity. What if the electron were more massive? What if I just made it heavier? What if atoms were more stable or less stable? There's forces in there holding them together. What if I messed around with those? What if there were different numbers of dimensions of space and time? This is one of the weird ones, sounds a bit like Doctor Who, but when you write down the equations that describe the universe, you can often write them down in a form that doesn't know about how many dimensions of space and time there are. You have to tell it three dimensions of space, one dimension of time, which allows you to sort of back up a bit and go, all right, what if I had four dimensions of space, or two dimensions of space, or two dimensions of time, which is a weird one. So what kind of universe could there have been? This is the question that leads us to the puzzle. Because if we look closely at an atom, and here's a nice simple picture of proton and neutron together in the nucleus, electron going around the outside, we can ask the question, what if we change the masses of those three fundamental pieces, right? There's the Lego set of the universe. A basic property of those bits is just how heavy are they, right? And if you had a really small set of scales, you get a quark, you stick it on, a number comes up. What if that number had been different? And you might just think, oh, all that's going to do is make everything in the universe just a bit heavier or a bit lighter. But that's not quite what happens, for the reason of the equation that was mentioned before, E equals mc squared. When energy is the currency of the universe, if you want something to happen, you've got to be able to pay for it in energy. And if there's not enough energy, then it's not going to happen, whatever process you're imagining. And what Einstein taught us in E equals mc squared is that matter is a form of energy, so mass goes into the budget. If you have enough energy, you can sort of buy a particle if you have enough energy to pay for the mass there. So what that's telling us is, in these processes, the masses of the fundamental bits is there in the budget. So if we change those numbers, we start to change the things that the universe can and can't afford, the processes that can and can't happen. The reason that's important is the way to make something stable in this analogy is to make it broke. The way you make sure nothing happens is if there's not enough energy around for something to happen. So if you want this particular nucleus to stay together, make sure that there's not enough energy there for either the neutron or the proton to break free of the bond. Then you've got a stable something. This is obviously important in the universe. We would like to wake up tomorrow with roughly the same DNA we have today. If we change these numbers, it turns out to be quite easy, with just some minor alterations, to make it so that there actually will be enough energy within any proton and neutron stuck together for them to break apart. And so that system is no longer stable. You just change the numbers a bit. Actually, you can make it so that instead of the proton going around the outside, it spirals into the nucleus and forms a neutron. So here's what happens in those universes. Here's the periodic table, just for some fun. This is the astronomer's periodic table. It's coloured according to where that element is made in the universe. So the hydrogen and helium are made in the Big Bang. If you want to make these yellow ones over here, you'll need a small star. But the green ones require an even larger, hotter, denser star before they get made. The way you make something is you smash smaller nuclei together to make larger ones. And these orange ones, even large stars won't get big enough and hot enough to make those. You actually have to blow the star up in a supernova, and then you get those elements. So, for example, if you know your elements, there's Au, which is gold. So if you have a gold ring on tonight, that was probably made in a supernova. Star had to blow up for that, so you know, be grateful or something. There's a bunch down the bottom here that nature didn't bother to make, so we had to make them ourselves. Here's what that table looks like if protons no longer stick to neutrons. Right? If the stuff in the universe doesn't stick to itself, you don't make anything. Right? It's like a Lego set, but none of the connectors work. Right? It's a lump in a stuff in a box. That's all you ever get. Okay? So when I do this talk for uni students, they really appreciate the following point, that in this universe, the chemistry exam goes like this. Question one, what is the element? There's one. Good. Question two, what is the chemical reaction? Because there's only one. You can put two hydrogen molecules, hydrogen atoms together to make a molecule. And that's the end of the chemistry exam, because there's no more chemistry. That's it. There's nothing else to talk about. So in these universes, that's as complicated as the story gets. So that story we can tell of our universe, right? Quarks, protons, nuclei, atoms, molecules, cells, little people, right? That story gets cut off. You can't make bigger things. Quarks, protons, that's it. That's all that happens in these universes. Right? There's just nothing else that happens. This particular fact, the fact that a small change in the fundamental properties of the universe leaves it much less able to support any form of complexity, is known as the fine-tuning of the universe for life. Bit of a tip, if you ever give me a talk about this at a high school, you'll need to explain what this is. But That's the picture, right? If you want a particular channel, you need to dial it right in, because a little bit this way is going to be static and a little bit that way is going to be static. Within the laws of nature as we know them, there's nothing in those laws that tell us what an electron's supposed to weigh, what its mass is supposed to be. So we have a range that it could be. We know what it is from experiments, but we have a handle on what could have been the case in the universe and of all the possibilities for the electron. If you want something interesting to happen, like chemistry, like things to stick together, then you have to land in a fairly narrow range. That's the fine-tuning of the universe for life. We can do this also on a large scale. This is something that I do for a living, which is kind of amazing. Nah, forget it. Not worth it. So we want to know how galaxies form. So here's one of the things that we do. You take a supercomputer, you take a volume of the universe, you break it up into individual particles, in your computer, of course, and then you sort of teach those particles how to interact. They interact via gravity. They feel pressure when they're close to each other. If they get close enough and hot enough and dense enough, they will form stars. And in certain circumstances, those stars will blow up and actually drive matter back out into the universe. You then take the universe as we think it is in its earliest stages, which is almost perfectly smooth, and then you hit play and you hope that it all works properly. And at the end of it, you make a lovely picture like this. This particular simulation, if you try to run it on a computer like this, will take 500 years, so you don't do that. You run it on 5,000 computers for about a month and a half. But at the end of that, you get this picture of the universe about how structure forms. And I'm going to run it again because that was an awful lot of effort to make that happen, so why don't we enjoy it twice? The hero of this story is really gravity. Because gravity for matter is always attractive, if you've got a lump of matter that's sort of more dense than average, it'll be able to pull other things in towards it. And so any lump of matter in the universe grows, becomes a bigger lump of matter, and so structure breeds more structure. The rich get richer, and the universe eventually comes to have this particular kind of structure that you have dense bits of the universe drawing things into them. Galaxies in there are forming, and between them there are these filaments where matter is sort of still deciding which way it's going to fall, towards this lump or towards this lump. This is known as the cosmic web. What we've been doing is changing the rules, changing the laws, changing the numbers to describe how the start of the universe happened. In particular, we know from our universe that the expansion of the universe is accelerating. So pick a galaxy out there. We've known since Lemaître, but Hubble-ish, since the 20s and 30s, that galaxy out there is going to be moving away from us. But what we discovered from 1998 was not only is it moving away from us, it's moving faster today than it was yesterday. That's the acceleration of the universe. So there must be some form of energy that's causing that. And so what we can do, we can measure that. But what we did with our simulations was say, what if that form of energy, known as dark energy, had been different? What if we changed it? So we did. Here's what you're going to see when I hit play. On this side, you're going to see basically the same story you saw before. Structure will form, galaxies will form, interesting stuff will happen in the universe. Over on these two panels, there's a certain amount of energy in this form of dark energy in the universe. We just took how much there is in our universe and said, let's make 10 times more, or let's do 100 times more, and see what it does to the universe. So you hit play and you see what happens. They start off quite similarly, but after a certain point, this dark energy makes the expansion of the universe accelerate earlier and earlier. And so while this one is happily forming structure, this one, everything is starting to accelerate from everything else. So gravity trying to pull things in suddenly finds that the rest of the universe is an awfully long way away, and so this one shuts down. This one has less structure than this one. There's less of the cosmic web there. And what that's telling us is if you change this number, you actually end up with a universe that doesn't do anything interesting. And if you look at the total range that this dark energy could have, cosmological constant, is another word for it, of the total range, the range in which anything interesting happens at all, even that would count, is remarkably small compared to the total range. the fraction is another, you know, 1 divided by 1 followed by 100 zeros at least. A ridiculously small number. In the vast majority of universes, if you just picked one of those at random, here's what would happen. You would have a proton in totally empty space. That's pretty much the whole story of the universe. Maybe once in a trillion years, another proton would come along and bounce off, and that would be it. That's all that would happen in the universe, right? It's a universe where the only kid's story you could write is called The Lonely Proton. That's the only story in the universe that actually happens, right? Everything else would be fictional. We can ruin the universe in some other interesting ways. If you get a good telescope and a good filter and point it at the sun, then this is what the sun looks like. If you stand outside during the day and look at the sun, you'll just burn your eyes, so don't do that. Take my word for it, this is sort of what it would look like. Stars, we've understood for a while now, since at least sort of the 30s and 40s, about what's going on. The short story is, because gravity is always pulling in, we need something to push out against the force of gravity to keep the star stable, and that thing is heat. Because the inside of the star is so hot, the pressure pushes back against gravity and stars are stable. That heat is generated and in particular maintained by nuclear reactions at the centre, and so the whole star sticks around for an awfully long period of time. But there's something else that needs to happen in stars that happens in our universe in the sun. They are stable in the following way. If the star decided one day to contract a little bit, to get a little bit smaller, then it would get hotter, it would get denser, those reactions would fire up, it would get more heat, and so that would push back against gravity and return it to where it started. So if you try to squeeze the sun, it goes back to where it was. If the sun expands a little bit, gravity will get a hold and pull it back to where it started. And so again, if the sun won't expand forever, it'll just stay roughly where it is. This is how you make something stable. If you make gravity stronger, and you don't have to do much, actually, but if you make gravity stronger, you make stars which kind of overreact. Rather than going back to where they started, if they ever pulse or undergo some sort of change, they overreact, pulse, and then sort of blow up. The nuclear reactions at the centre overreact if they get compressed, and so eventually the whole star kind of blows itself to smithereens. So those are some examples of this puzzle, this conundrum called the fine-tuning of the universe for life. There are some fundamental properties of our universe. We don't know why they are the way they are, but remarkably small changes to them end up with a universe that doesn't support anything like complexity, anything like life. So the first six chapters of our book are sort of dedicated to a whole heap of different examples of this from a number of fields in physics. So I wrote the book with Geraint, who was my honours and master's supervisor, is now my colleague. He is an atheist. And he's also Welsh. One of those is shocking. It's the first one, right? Okay, good. We wrote the first seven chapters together. And apart from one footnote, which I'll leave you to find if you buy the book, loads of fun, apart from one footnote which begins, at this point our heroic authors disagreed about ... we basically agreed on all the science that was in the book. And then came chapter 8, which is the last chapter of the book, where we tried to work out what on earth all of this means. So the science is fairly straightforward, right? This is what theoretical physics does. If the universe obeyed this particular equation with these numbers in it, what would happen, right? That's basically my job description. It's kind of amazing. So that we can do. What we want to know is, what does this mean, the fact that small changes kind of ruin everything? So here was Geraint's preferred solution. It's something called the multiverse, which has started turning up in comic books for some reason. This is Infinite Crisis, Fight for the Multiverse is the subtitle there. Batman's involved for some reason. The idea is, it's an explanation along the following lines. Think about the question, why does anyone win the lottery? Well, it's because lots of people buy different tickets, and you need both of those things. It wouldn't be much help if only two people bought tickets to the lottery. It would still be unlikely that anyone won. And it wouldn't be helpful if a million people all bought the same ticket with the same numbers. That wouldn't help either. But if lots of people buy different tickets, the probability of the right one coming up somewhere goes up. So here's the idea. Maybe, sure, it's very unlikely that any sort of random universe gets the right combination of constants, the right combination of properties for life to happen. But maybe there's lots of other universes out there. Other universes just in the sense that they have different values of these numbers. Maybe if you go far enough that way, way beyond what our telescopes can see, maybe you'll find electrons that weigh a bit more or a bit less. And maybe if we could zoom way, way out on the universe, this is what we would see. We would see that our universe was this sort of oasis where interesting stuff happens. But in the next universe over, it was also close, but it didn't quite get the electron mass right or the quark mass right or the cosmological constant blew everything to smithereens before the universe came along. These ones all had explosive stars. There's a whole heap of dead universes around which didn't quite get it right, but if there's enough variety, there's enough universes around, then eventually somewhere, some lucky universe, some fortunate universe, is going to get the right answer. And that's Geraint's preferred solution, that we need to do some more cosmology. Now, there was a fairly active debate amongst scientists along the following question. Is this science? On the one hand, it seems like, you know, if you think you know how the universe as a whole is, some statistical properties of how everything works out, then you can sort of predict what we'd expect to see. On the other hand, other scientists have pointed out, quite senior scientists actually, that, you know, we're supposed to be doing science here. This is supposed to be empirical, supposed to be based on observations. And the main prediction of these models, the one that matters, is that in other bits of the universe there are different properties, and it's precisely that prediction we'll never be able to test because they're too far away in the vast majority of these models, right? The next suburb over where you get the different electron mass is way too far away for us to see. So that's an open question, but it's a question for me that's kind of a scientific question. So actually I don't really have much of an opinion about the multiverse model. Maybe it's true, maybe it's not. I think that even if it is true, there's still something in here that's pointing to something deeper. And so what I talk about in the book is the idea that there is a fine tuner. So here's sort of an analogy. Any Zelda? Anyone else spend... Yeah, anyone else spend 90 hours playing? No? Okay, good. I'll share this tidbit of information with you, just store it away. My kids started watching me playing Zelda. They're quite young. Five and eight. And they, Daddy was playing this video game, Daddy was in a movie and controlling it. It was kind of interesting. And so they started requesting that I play the video games. And so we started using it as a reward. And you've nailed parenting when you get to say the sentence, if you clean your room, I'll play video games. Probably the smartest thing I've ever accidentally done. So, within these worlds, they're their own self-contained thing. They have their own rules, and so you could imagine after the quest is over and Zelda has some, Link, of course, has some free time, that they could go and start working out what the laws of their universe are, and they might actually get quite successful in it. They might know how every little bit, what the basic bits of their universe are and how all the bits work together. And so they could actually, you could imagine them actually almost writing down the source code, right? Actually writing down the rules of their universe, and they'd sort of have solved things. On one level, they'd have learned an awful lot about their own reality. On another level, they would have just raised a whole heap of questions underneath that more looking around at Hyrule will not solve for them. If they're starting to wonder, why these rules rather than some other ones? Why are we in The Legend of Zelda rather than, you know, Mario Odyssey? And why is there a world at all for these rules to describe? They've asked questions that further looking around the various bits of the universe, their universe, will not help them solve. They're simply deeper questions. You either abandon them or you have to go for a level of explanation which is beyond the sort of physics of their universe. And one of the things they might notice is that their world is quite well put together, okay? And if they could ever get a peek at the source code, they would work out that actually the way the sort of large features of the world are well put together because it's well put together at the bottommost level. And so there's kind of a principle here. I think fine-tuning is pointing towards a way of testing two different ideas about what we would do if we ever sort of solved the universe and finished physics. What would we do? Maybe you could be a naturalist. You say that the universe is the only stuff. Natural stuff is the only stuff. Or you say that there's a design. There is a principle underneath it all that involves a reason of a mind. And I think we can sort of attack this with a principle. This is a principle from probability theory. And it's quite simple. You have to ask the question. It's not the only question, but it's a very important one. What would we expect to be the case if a theory were true? You've got some idea about the way things are supposed to work. What would we expect on the basis of that idea? So here's an example. Suppose you're watching some security footage and you see that a safe has been robbed, but the robber walked up to the safe and on the first attempt punched in the correct code and opened the safe and took all the stuff out. That's the facts. What would we think? Well, we might consider two ideas. Maybe it was an inside job. Maybe someone who knew the code told the thief before they turned up. Or B, maybe they guessed the code. They just walked up, had a crack, and got it. Now, one way to think through this is just to say, what would we expect to be the case if the theory were true? Suppose it were really true that it was an inside job. What would we expect? We would expect the thief to walk up and punch in the correct code. It's not certain, it doesn't have to be certain. You know, they might punch in the wrong code accidentally, someone might have given them the wrong code, you know, to set them up or something. But that's at least quite likely. On the other hand, what would we expect to be the case if they guessed the code? Well, overwhelmingly, suppose it's a 12-digit code, some random 12-digit code. Overwhelmingly, except for one time in a trillion, we would expect them to walk up, guess a code and get it wrong. The problem with that theory is what we expect is not what happened. And it's those two coming together where the problem starts. And so I think thinking then about naturalism, if you think the universe is the only stuff, you've got to ask, okay, what sort of universe would I expect there to be if the natural world was all that there was? And the crucial thing I'd say there is, there's no deeper principles underneath the laws of nature. So any possible law of nature could have been the actual one. Right? Any mathematically consistent equation will do. Right? I'm a theoretical physicist. I've got whole pens full of equations. Right? There's loads of those. And what fine-tuning is telling us is that most of those don't do anything interesting like our universe. What sort of universe would you expect on naturalism? You would expect a dead one. Almost certainly. Because doing interesting stuff like us is quite difficult, quite fine-tuned. What you can then do is try to put yourself in the shoes of a theist and try to think about that way of thinking about the world. How does someone who believes in God think about these sorts of things? Well, because fundamental reality, the most fundamental thing that exists, is more like a mind than like matter. The way you explain things is not in terms of causes, but in terms of reasons. And so our expectations about what we might expect if God existed are fueled by reasons for the universe. And if this universe has a sufficient reason, then we might expect God to create it. And I would suggest that one reason God might have is that this is a morally significant universe. It's one in which interesting moral things happen. It's one in which love is possible, but it's not automatic. Our universe is not morally trivial. It's not like, you know, whatever you do, great things are going to happen. But it's not trivial in the other way as well, that whatever you do, you can't have any impact on the universe at all. We're living in the kind of place where if you want something good to happen, then pull your socks up and get on with it, because you're going to have to make it happen. So that's how I think this branches out. Geraint disagrees, of course. And so if you want to see us duke that out in Chapter 8, then you'll enjoy the book, available on audiobook, which is an awful lot of effort, so please do go and buy that one. So I'll leave it there. That's the state of play, right? So two people who totally understand the science completely disagree about what all of this means, and so I'll open it up for questions. Thank you.
It was a long one. Sorry. Get some more lights. Yeah, grab a seat. Hey, excellent, that's what I was after.
Well, thank you for sharing that book. I guess one of my questions is to do with the book and how it came about. Geraint, is that right?
Yeah.
Geraint was your supervisor while you're doing your honours and your PhD.
Masters.
While you're doing your masters and your PhD. And now this book. What was the process of how did you go from knowing him as your supervisor to the book coming about?
So Geraint had always wanted to write a book. His reasoning was, so he's got sort of 300 published papers, he's that stage of his career. And he's like, I don't need another paper, I want to do something else. Mm-hmm. That was his. And so he always wanted to write one, and at a time when he was trying to think through what subject to write it on, I gave a talk not too dissimilar to the opening half of this one to actually the astronomers at Sydney University, just to sort of go, you know, this is weird, isn't it? And out of that, he said, all right, let's write a book about this. This is perfect. He sort of knew about it. It's there and thereabouts in the literature, but it's a slightly wrong topic. So that's how that started.
Okay. And given that you have different worldviews or different kind of takes on the cause of fine-tuning, what was that process like? Where did you have verbal fisticuffs, or did you learn things along the way, or...?
Oh, we learned loads along the way.
Okay.
But we still don't know how publishing works, but... So it was actually fairly smooth, like, as I said before, we agreed about an awful lot of stuff. So we've written papers, we've written 10 or so papers before we wrote the book.
Right.
So we were used to writing them together. And it was fairly... at least the first bit was fairly smooth. And then the dialogue at the end... There were a few things we thought through, and we agreed about a lot of that stuff as well. The multiverse was kind of, you know, neither of us is totally at home with it. And then the sort of God section, one of the things that sort of both of us wanted to do was there'd been previous books about fine tuning, which had sort of fobbed off the God hypothesis in about a paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a book by a guy called Leonard Susskind who said, this is really noisy, who says, maybe there's a creator, but let's not bother with that. And that's basically as much as he said about it. So we wanted to do something that, and he was quite keen to do something that actually set out that case. So that was, fine.
Okay.
Should I tell a story about how we started? It's not true, but it would be more exciting.
So I first came across your work, I guess people who were... So your book has 6 chapters on science, and then 1 chapter on false leads, is that right? Or
Just the ways that people react to
fine-tuning.
It's kind of interesting when you give talks that usually, you know, not much happens. So when I gave the talk to the astronomers in Sydney, there's like an hour and a half of questions afterwards. And not just questions to me, like everyone's talking to everyone else about what on earth is going on. Mm-hmm. This never happens because usually after an astronomy talk, it's lunchtime, and so everyone leaves. So it just generates. So we sort of collected a lot of those questions and tried to answer the ones we thought were going down the wrong track.
Okay. A few years ago, City Wildlife Forum had Lawrence Krauss come and do an event here in Perth, and he kind of comes down on the side of the multiverse, is that right?
Yeah, I think so.
But he's tried to... What do you make of his... I read my first cosmology book was his one a couple of years ago, and I've enjoyed this a lot more. I must say.
Oh, good,
can't get this one. But at the end of that, he seems to say that a universe can come out of nothing.
Right.
What do you make of his answers to the problem of fine tuning?
So that book was more specifically about why there's a universe at all, rather than why it's specifically fine tuned. I think he thinks a multiverse would explain it. If you just vary things enough, then something will turn up. But one of the problems is you need some specific model for a multiverse, which we don't really have.
Mm-hmm.
But the point I try to make, you know, there in the book, is that, you know, there's a deeper issue here, even if the multiverse seems like it's on top of things, right? There's still this question of why things are right for life when there's so many cases they're not right for life. And I think the multiverse won't necessarily totally solve that problem.
Okay.
happy to slander Lawrence Krauss for longer.
All right. Yeah. No, okay. Someone that you might not want to slander. So is Stephen Hawking. He wrote that book a couple of years ago, and in it said that we don't need a God to kick things off. Is that right?
Yeah.
Was he trying to address the same question, or he was addressing the question of what started things?
Yeah, so I think Hawking went for the multiverse option as well.
Mm-hmm.
He was quite explicit about that this fine-tuning stuff is a real problem. We've got to do something about it. Is this cutting in and out?
Yes.
Sorry. You can ditch it if you like.
I'm noisy enough. Hawking, in his published work, talked about... He actually published papers on fine-tuning in one of the early papers in the late 70s, I think, just about one particular way the universe is fine-tuned. And so his answer was the multiverse for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
The point he made in that other book was, again, about the ultimate origin of why there's a universe at all. So his answer there was, you know, there's supposedly these natural scenarios in which a universe appears out of something that's very different from our universe. And with a bit of creative work there, you call that other thing nothing, and then you've got something coming out of nothing.
Mm-hmm.
That's not particularly convincing if you understand the philosophical question you started with.
Okay. And so you are arguing with Grinks for the theist side of the mm-hmm. equation. Why is it, more broadly, that you prefer theism to naturalism as a solution to this problem?
So I think there's a number of things, and theism, for me, Christianity is a worldview. It's a total system of the way the world is. I think one of the problems with some of the naturalists I talk to is they treat the existence of God as if it was like we'd learned the existence of unicorns or something. They have their way the world is, and then if we discover unicorns, you just add one extra thing in the list of stuff that exists. Whereas actually, as I said, if you put a mind at the bottom, you've got to turn the whole thing upside down.
Give Luke a mic.
Oh, sorry.
I can't hear what you're saying.
Sorry, sir.
I can't, anyway.
Sorry. That's important. Thank you.
Sorry. The mic was cutting in and out, so I put it off. Let me start again. Good luck, everyone.
You were saying that Christianity is a world...
So Christianity is kind of a worldview. It's a total system. So there's an awful lot of things that come into this. For me, as a scientist, it's a bit like getting to the end of, working out how the computer game totally works and then having all these questions underneath. So if you want an answer to the question of why does the universe exist at all, science sort of discovering another thing, just another, thing on the list of stuff that exists isn't going to help. Right, just discovering like another unicorn or something. It's not going to tell you why anything at all exists. You need a different kind of thing. And so the idea of God that I get out of Christianity, and it's kind of there in Plato and Aristotle and some of the Eastern religions as well, it has that in common with them, that the idea of the reason for whom's existence is found within itself. So for everything that exists like us, the reason for my existence is found in something that's not me, and the reason for their existence is in something else. So we all sort of, why does anything exist? We all sort of pass the buck. It's a bit like, I got this book, I borrowed it off that person, and they borrowed it off that person, they borrowed it off that person. Someone's got to have made the book in the first place. You need an entity that explains its own existence. And so I find that within that, so the picture of God then as just a different kind of thing entirely. It's not as like just another scientific thing, like another equation or something.
Mm.
It's a necessary being. Then gives you an awful lot. Why is there something rather than nothing? Why is there a universe? Would there be a good reason for a universe? Why does it support life like this? Well, because there's a moral value to life. Understanding of sort of moral values, there's something for those to attach onto that's not just human convention. There's what Plato called the good. So in all of those ways.
Mm, okay. And for you personally, how have you chosen between these different theistic claims, like the God of Plato or Aristotle or a God that they described, and I guess there's the Abrahamic religions all have this theistic self-sufficient God in common.
Right.
How have you chosen between Islam and Plato and Christianity?
So historically, I was brought up as a Christian, so I can't claim like I sort of floated around in the ether as a totally objective, unbiased. So no, we're all the product of our histories. But the things I've been talking about tonight don't really give you much of a way of choosing between those ideas of God. You need something which is capable of it being the cause of the universe and a necessary being. And that's a lot, right? I mean, Zeus is off the table for a start. Zeus occasionally turns into a, you know, goose and does things with ladies. I was talking with a very well-known philosopher in Sydney a couple of weeks ago, Peter Slezak, who likes to talk about Quetzalcoatl,
right,
as this...
He did at a previous...
Yeah.
Event. Yeah.
And so I looked up Quetzalcoatl and found out that he's a feathered snake who at one point had such a... You know, got so drunk that he and his sister did embarrassing things, and so in his shame the next morning he set himself on fire. Now, if you're looking for the ultimate cause of reality, Quetzalcoatl's not really who you're after. So I find on all of those sort of gods with a small g, I'm trying to reach for a deeper reason for why reality is the way it is. And so I think, you know, just reach harder and you'll reach for a god who is sort of perfect and necessary. But then you've got to decide between, say, Christianity and Islam on different grounds.
Mm.
And, you know, Islam makes historical claims. Jesus didn't die on a cross. Right? So you can then do history and try and work out whether he did die on a cross or not, and decide on the basis of that between those two.
Mm-hmm.
So there are ways to sort through that. It's just fine-tuning, it's not one of them.
We might go to question time in just a moment, because I'm sure lots of people have good questions, but I get to ask one more.
Go for it.
Perth is a very practical place. We're proud that we've built this city on sand. What's the bottom line of what you've been talking about tonight? What difference does the fine-tuning of the universe for life make to you personally?
I think on two grounds, if I'm trying to think through ideas about why the universe is the way it is, and so try and read things by people who don't, you know, agree with the way I see the world, and in particular naturalism, you know, I feel the pull of that as a scientist. There's a quote from Douglas Adams, who wrote Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, who was an atheist. He just said, you know, can't we just enjoy the garden without pretending that there are fairies at the bottom of the garden? Meaning, can't we just enjoy the physical universe without creating some god, you know, way off somewhere for some stupid reason, right? I feel the simplicity of that. So I think what fine-tuning reminds me is that actually naturalism does make claims about the way we would expect ultimate reality to be. And those claims, so far as I can tell, are wrong. We would expect this doesn't look like just any old universe. As you know, Bertrand Russell, most atheists would have said before fine-tuning came along, this is just sort of any old universe where just any old bit of matter in some weird corner and, you know, stuff just happens. That's not the picture we're actually getting from physics.
Well, if you want to ask a question, I think my colleague Lainey is going to grab the microphone and bring it your way. So please just pop your hand up and Lainey will come to you.
Thank you for a fascinating talk. I do not know much about physics, astrophysics, but where does string theory fit into all of this, quarks and things like it? My understanding was that string theory is at least more primitive or more simpler than quarks, but I don't know enough about it to be able to comment.
Yeah, so that's the idea. So when we look at sort of particles, there are a sort of list of basic particles in the universe. I've shown you three, but there's some more. The idea behind string theory is this. If the fundamental stuff of the universe is not these different types of particles, but one type of thing, a string, and then the different way that the string can vibrate corresponds to these different particles. And so that, if that idea is right, it's kind of amazing, right? Instead of all, you know, 17 different types of thing, you have one type of thing that just behaves different ways. You know, you make it wobble this way and it's an up quark. You make it wobble that way, it's a down quark. And then hey, presto, all the physics is right there in the strings. To raise some weirdness, you have to do this in 10 spatial dimensions, by the way. The universe has to be 10 dimensional. You have to fold up 7 of those dimensions. Anyway, really hard. String theory is an idea that would be deeper than this. And so the question is, if string theory turns out to be correct, and it's been since the early 80s that people have been trying to work out whether it is correct, and so far no evidence one way or another has turned up. I mean, it's an extraordinarily ambitious theory, so, you know, I don't know if that's enough time. But if we had string theory sort of tomorrow totally confirmed for us, we'd do the same sort of thing. We'd try and say, okay, if you're a naturalist, you might expect any old set of strings. Would we get some of those strings doing something interesting or something boring? One of the interesting things is string theory, the hope of it is all of the stuff that are just like the mass of the electron are things that you could calculate, right? You could get your, you know, you just take the equations and you end up calculating. No one's done that calculation, but that's the hope. What turned out in sort of the early 2000s is it looks like actually there's not one answer to that question. It depends how you set the strings up to start with. And so all of the variation you can do with the standard model of just let's take an electron mass and change it a bit. We can do all the same sorts of variation with a string. It wouldn't be a fundamental constant in the equation. It would be something about the way the universe was set up in the start, but it would still be completely unexplained by physics. So a lot of the same questions would probably come out.
You seem to think that the world is billions of years old.
Yep.
And my Bible tells me that it's a few thousand. And I cannot, I've never found any evidence supporting evolution. The billions of years philosophy requires evolution. There's never been one shred of evidence that's held up supporting evolution. So then things didn't evolve, because otherwise we would know. And I believe that God created complete systems, and he put the fossils in the ground, for instance. I don't know why, but he probably gets a laugh out of the fact that we collect these things and say that they're very old. And your beautiful pictures of things blowing up, I believe that he just made it like that. And so I wonder what you have to say about evolution.
So I'm not a biologist, for the start. I don't interpret Genesis in that way. I don't, as a Christian, I don't find that it's trying to teach me things about the age of the universe, but that's a very much an open question. I'm not a theologian. If you did think that that's the time scale of the universe, then as I've presented fine-tuning, it's kind of creating an internal problem for the atheist, right? Even if the naturalist, even their best theories seem to have this internal problem that you still don't get that our universe is likely. So there's still a problem there. And then there's the question, so it's more of an internal question between Christians about, you know, how we interpret Genesis and all of that. It's a huge issue. I wouldn't say I don't personally have any particular problem with evolution. One of the reasons for that is even if it happened, the second law of thermodynamics says that more orderly systems become less orderly. Always. So if evolution happened, it's still an example of that. So even granted, so this is the absolute, just absolutely standard cosmology. The early universe is an orderly place, and you need an enormous amount of order in order for interesting stuff to happen in the universe, including evolution if it happened. On top of that, I'd have some theological issues with God just sticking fossils in the ground for no reason. I can see why God might, if God was just going to make a universe like that, he might need to make some stuff that's sort of there ready to go from the start, right? We might want to have an atmosphere when Adam and Eve turn up in the garden, but why on earth 5,500 years later, when you dig down, you find fossils that seem to be of species that never really existed? Or if we look up in the night sky, we can quite easily see things that are further than 6,000 light years away. Why God would do that is for me, there would be no reason for that. So I have I'm skeptical about that side. But fundamentally, you know, I don't think Genesis is tying us down to any particular time scale. A lot of people disagree with me about that. Even if you are a young Earth creationist, there's still an internal problem for naturalism that fine-tuning points out. So I think there's still something interesting to be thought about within all of these issues.
A question for the mathematician in you. What's the statistical probability of this universe working in a multiverse?
So that's a huge open question. So so as a physicist, what I want to model, right? Tell me what you think the universe is like. Tell me with enough precision that I can go say, all right, if that's true, I would expect this, I would expect that. So in a multiverse model, what I want to be able to do is do the statistics of, all right, there's all these other universes out there. Let's, in our minds, get out our clipboard and go around to everyone in the universe and go, if knock on the door of the universe, most of them no one answers because there's no one there. But if someone does answer, say, all right, for example, what's the cosmological constant in your universe? And if the vast majority of people give an answer different to what we give, then that's a sort of failed prediction of the model. Because, you know, it's making a prediction there about what we would expect. And that's exactly what the sort of paper we've written out of those simulations is on about. It seems to be the case that if these ideas were true, unless you jerry-rig them in sort of suspicious ways, we wouldn't expect to have the universe that we have. We'd expect to sort of be clinging on for life in the outer reaches of the one galaxy in the observable universe, which is not what we see. We see a universe all around us. So the answer depends on the model, but that's kind of the way of testing the model. Do we get the universe we would expect? And that's kind of an open question. One of the problems is there's no standard multiverse model. There's nothing like, there's the standard model of particle physics. There's the standard story about the acceleration. There's no standard model of the multiverse that says, here's the one, go and investigate that.
Now, one of the things that I find really intriguing and compelling is that I think it was the astronomer George Greenstein, I think, who complained about all these fellow astronomers who were going off and joining the Church of Jesus Christ of the Big Bang. Basically because the Big Bang itself just seemed to be so compelling that the start point for both time and space for the universe, and, you know, the sort of intriguing considering the beauty principle, what is the simplest explanation for the Big Bang having happened? And then you have people like Fred Hoyle, strong atheist, putting forward the theory that, well, actually it was Cyanean intelligence that created the universe as we know it, or others going to the multiverse model and so on. Mm-hmm. It's almost like there's a grasping for anything but God going on. But the recognition that this is a compelling argument for the existence of a God. And when you look at the Bible, you see so many verses that talk about God being around before time and space and outside of time and space and so on. And then when you start considering string theory in 10 dimensions, if he is outside of time and space and all those 10 dimensions, you sort of think, wow, if a being's able to move in all those 10 dimensions, can you imagine the things that they can do? So it's almost as if science has discovered that, yes, there is a heck of a lot more out there beyond our time, our own little dimensions, and opening up the possibility of heavenly dimensions, of other dimensions where spiritual beings could be. I just find that really gripping and strengthening my faith.
So there's a very interesting sort of initial reaction to the Big Bang theory as it comes out. I mentioned Lemaître before. He was a Belgian priest who was also a sort of cosmologist on the side. Right? He was one of the sort of beginners of this theory, but as a physical theory, not as trying to sort of throw God in where, you know, to some physical universe, right? Which is not the Christian idea, right? What's outside, in some sense. But there's a very interesting sort of set of complaints about the model through the 40s, 50s, and 60s from people, including Hoyle, and Hoyle never really got over it. The alien thing was actually about how life on Earth started, so, which is weird, but I won't touch that, I'm not a biologist. So that's kind of interesting. We're at an interesting point now where you can look over the last century of cosmology and you can say, all right, every time that you have a model of the universe, and it's always in a model because you never directly see the beginning, but every time there's a model in which there is a beginning, it always sort of turned up there where no one wanted it. No one tried to put one in, and it just kept turning up. And to the point where we thought we got rid of it and thought it's back again, right? Loads of time over the, as you know, throughout the whole thing. And every time we found a model which didn't have a beginning, it was because they really tried hard to not have the beginning. That said, if you're a naturalist, there is some basic way that the universe is and you just stop there. And so it's always an option for the naturalist to just bite the bullet and say, that's how the universe is, because they have to do that at some point anyway. I don't find that particularly convincing, but, you know, some naturalists will bite the bullet on that. Regarding other dimensions, I think that's at best an analogy, but it's kind of an interesting one. If you're a four-dimensional being, so imagine there was a two-dimensional being that sort of lived on the screen, and then we came along, right? You would have almost godlike powers. You could sort of appear at any point and disappear out of rooms, and you know, you'd be sort of almost, you know, indestructible. I don't want to say that God exists in some extra dimension, because God is supposed to be the creator of space and time himself. But it's kind of an interesting analogy about, you know, there's a very interesting way in which you could have almost godlike powers just by throwing in an extra dimension and having some fun.
Extra dimension of time.
Yeah, those ones are weird, as you might have guessed. One of the things that's weird about having an extra dimension of time is that conservation laws are different. So remember I said if you want something to be stable, you need to make it broke in terms of energy. Conservation of energy is related to a time symmetry. So if you have two dimensions of time, you have two conserved energies. Three dimensions of space, you have three conserved momentum, by the way, that's all happening. If you have two conserved energies, you have weird things where you can actually, you don't have a bottom floor. If you run out of this energy, you borrow against that energy and you keep going on. So things aren't stable. So actually, weird stuff, as you would hope to happen, if you have two time dimensions, weird stuff happens.
I just wanted to know what you thought and whether you saw any real value in the Hadron Collider and how's it going, if you know anything about that.
Oh, yeah. So I mentioned the Hadron Collider, you know, just whack two protons together as hard as you can to see what happens. One of the things that came out of that was the particle that was first proposed in the 60s. It was kind of the last piece of the standard model of particle physics. There were reasons to think it was there, but we'd never made it before because we had to whack stuff together really hard, called the Higgs boson, and it finally turned up, and high fives all around. What you really want from a new experiment is new stuff that you don't understand, because then there's new puzzles. There's a great quote from a physicist called Ed Hines who just said, the reason we do physics is because the universe is like the biggest, baddest jumbo crossword puzzle you've ever seen. So what we want the Hadron Collider to do is to discover more bits of the crossword puzzle. So there's a couple of things we were hoping that would turn up that haven't quite turned up yet, but it's relatively early days. We were hoping that we might see evidence of a few other sort of possibilities. It's in the end a fairly simple experiment in principle. Just whack two protons together and see what comes out.
Just given that you've explained earlier on that there's such a very narrow way that God has created the universe, and it's in such a perfect way, and you've studied the universe, what are your thoughts on where is heaven and what it's like?
So if I think that God is the creator of space and time, then I don't, then God is sort of beyond that. And so I don't want to say that, you know, heaven is just, you know, left at Albuquerque and on until morning, right? So I don't really have an opinion about those sorts of things. I find the picture in the Bible that I get is of a new heavens and a new earth. So actually, the afterlife is here in a restored universe, not sort of off in some other dimension, right? This world will be redeemed, not just abandoned. So there's a whole heap of stuff like that in the Bible where the answer for me is I don't know. I would love to know, but that, yeah, that's the guesses I can make.
Lainey, we might make this the last question, if that's okay. Oh, this gentleman here.
Yeah, go on.
Luke, would you please comment on the fact that since the Big Bang, a lot of scientists now are saying that suddenly that the whole universe came from nothing?
Yeah, so... In the normal picture of the Big Bang, the beginning of the universe really is a boundary on space and time. So it's like the question, what's north of the North Pole? There isn't a place that's north of the North Pole. So what's before the Big Bang? There isn't a time before the Big Bang. That's where time started. So that if that's true, then that's the sort of the beginning of the material universe, the beginning of everything. And so the question then is, you could then as a naturalist bite the bullet and say the universe just came out of nothing and that's all there is to say about it. That would not be a scientific statement. You just have to say that as the founding principle of your metaphysics, your ontology, whatever, your philosophy. But if you sort of follow, you know, if you think that everything that exists needs a reason why it exists, either in itself or in something other than itself, if you think that things that have beginnings have causes, if you think that there must be an explanation for why things are the way they are rather than otherwise, any of those sort of causal principles or explanatory principles, any of those, if you think those are more likely to be true than not, and then you see an entire universe just popping into existence, you're going to need some sort of cause, some sort of explanation, which is beyond the universe, which is not part of the universe, which is itself the cause of space and time themselves. The open question there is, of course, what does science really say about the beginning of the universe? And there's a bit of a fuzzy picture there, right? So Einstein's theory predicts that beginning, but there are reasons to think that Einstein's theory isn't the full story because it doesn't incorporate quantum mechanics. So there's a lot of interesting sort of back and forth that's going on there. From my perspective, the more satisfying thing for me is just, you know, even if the universe were infinitely old, that wouldn't give us a reason why it exists rather than nothing. And so if you want to answer that question, you better go beyond physics and beyond the universe.
Well, if you can't, if scientists still can't work out...
Quick, while the microphone's coming out the front.
If you still... All the scientists can't work out how everything began. I mean, they're turning over and tumbling over each other trying to work out what the cause was. Well, what about the speeding up of the universe? I mean, have they got any theories on what it means and what the outcome is and how come it's speeding up?
So what we have is equations that can describe that totally accurately. Mm. In order to do that, we have to make an assumption about a form of energy in the universe. Mm. And we see the evidence of that form of energy in the expansion, in the acceleration. Dark energy is what it's called. The only reason you call something dark energy if you don't know what it is. Obviously. So what we would love is for this dark energy to do something else, to turn up somewhere else so we could work out what it is. That we don't have. Same with dark matter. There's some form of matter which has gravitational attraction. We can see its gravitational attraction. We just want it to do something else, just hit as something in a detector somewhere so we can work out what it is. But those are very much, the evidence is pointing towards something and we just want another way of getting at what this thing is, rather than the beginning, which is the evidence is pointing in a certain way but we're not sure about theories getting it, and things are a bit more
crazy. Well, it's certainly an interesting topic and you're an interesting man to listen to. So thank you for being here. Let's thank you.